Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Ayala, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Education Workshop. Today's program is focusing on emerging therapies in Hodgkin lymphoma, and this is a wonderful program today. We have just a wonderful group of faculty and speakers on the program today. We have all of you, and we have collaborated with a number of different cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration with all of the different organizations and, of course, your particular interest in this program, all of your interests, that we have so many of you on the call today. So we have on the call today over 567 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom, so it's really a bit of an international call. And we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. I do want to acknowledge that this program is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for supporting this very important program. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. David Strauss. Dr. Strauss is attending physician, Lymphoma Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He is professor of clinical medicine while Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Strauss is going to address an overview of Hodgkin lymphoma, staging and diagnosis, and current standard of care. It's really my great pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Strauss.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to be asked to speak to you. We're going to speak today about Hodgkin lymphoma, which is a type of malignant lymphoma, which is a term that's used for a type of blood cancer involving white blood cells called lymphocytes. It is one of the most successfully treatable cancers and has been so for many years. And our focus in recent years is to maintain these excellent results with less toxicity and long-term consequences of treatment. It's estimated that there will be 8,260 new cases in the United States in 2017 by the American Cancer Society, which makes it a fairly rare cancer. For example, there are probably 70,000 to 80,000 new cases of non-Hodgkin lymphoma per year and close to 200,000 new cases of breast cancer. It is largely a disease of children and young adults, but can be seen in older adults. It is especially common in individuals in their 20s. The average age is probably in the early 30s, but again, there is a population of older patients who also get it. It is an acquired disease, like most cancers. However, there are occasional families where brothers and sisters may have Hodgkin lymphoma, and there is a higher incidence in identical twins, that is, who are genetically the same, than in fraternal twins that are genetically different. So this suggests that there may be a genetic predisposition to acquiring this disease in some families that's a minority, but no gene has been identified to identify families at increased risk, such as is the case for breast cancer, where the BRCA genes can predict an increased risk in some families. There is some association of exposure to Epstein-Barr virus, particularly in later childhood or early adulthood, as in mononucleosis. Some varieties of Hodgkin lymphoma actually have genetic material from Epstein-Barr virus in the tumor cells, not all. Exactly what the role is of Epstein-Barr virus in the growth and initiation of Hodgkin lymphoma is as yet unknown, and it's not clear that whether or not this association has any impact on prognosis or outcome. The risk is higher in individuals with HIV infection. It is usually detected often by patients themselves who notice enlarged lymph nodes, particularly in the neck, in the groin area, or under the arms. Some patients will have symptoms, including increased itching, a very odd symptom of pain in the involved lymph node areas with drinking an alcoholic beverage, and with fevers, night sweats, or weight loss. The reason for these symptoms are not really known, but it's thought that Hodgkin lymphoma produces things called chemokines and cytokines that may cause these symptoms in some people. Three of these symptoms have been incorporated in the staging system, which I'll discuss in a minute, and these are called B symptoms. This is fevers, night sweats, and weight loss. Itching and alcohol-induced pain are not part of the staging system. The diagnosis is established, like all cancers, by biopsy. It is important to not only look at individual cancer cells in Hodgkin lymphoma, but also to look at the environment and the tissue in which they occur. So we really, a fine needle aspirate, where they just pull a few of the cancer cells into a syringe and make and stain them, usually not adequate to make a diagnosis. So the best way is to excise or completely remove a lymph node. Sometimes masses are large and only a piece of them will be removed. And sometimes the diagnosis can be made by a needle biopsy, provided it's a core biopsy that actually cuts out a little piece of the tumor. There are a number of other things that are done in the workup. There are a number of other effects from these chemokines and cytokines produced by the cancer cells that can have effects on blood tests, so that we get a blood count. We get blood chemistry studies, particularly looking at the chemistry studies related to the function of the liver and kidneys. There's a marker of inflammation called erythrocyte sedimentation rate, which we often get, which can be elevated in some patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. And we look for HIV because there is an association with HIV, although certainly that's a vast minority of cases. And because some of the treatments can reactivate hepatitis B, we always check for hepatitis B exposure in the blood. There are other tests that we need to get before we start treatment because of some of the drugs we use. We need to get a test to look at the function of the heart to make sure it's pumping blood efficiently. This can be done with an echocardiogram, which is like a sound wave test, or by a nuclear medicine test that's called a MUGA test. Also, for patients who have lung problems, we usually get a baseline pulmonary function test. This is the standard in many places. It probably isn't necessary in young patients who have no symptoms, but it is standard to do it as a baseline many places. Then we need imaging. The chest X-ray is the classic image. This can show enlargement of lymph nodes in the mediastinum, which is the area in the center of the chest. But really, more recently, we've been using CAT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis with contrast, and nuclear medicine test, the PET scan. Bone marrow involvement is pretty uncommon in Hodgkin lymphoma, and actually PET scan can show bone involvement probably better than bone marrow tests, so that we don't do bone marrow tests in most patients. We use a staging system that was devised actually 45 years ago by the Ann Arbor Staging committee, and this was modified 30 years ago by the so-called Cotswold modifications, and most recently by the Lugano classifications for staging in lymphoma. This staging system divides the body by the diaphragm, which is the muscle that divides the chest cavity from the abdominal cavity. There are four stages. Stage one would be disease just in one lymph node area. Stage two would be disease in two or more lymph node areas above or below the diaphragm. Spleen is considered to be a lymph node in the staging system, although it's lymph node-like. It's not actually a lymph node. And they have to be non-contiguous, for example, neck nodes and lymph nodes under the arms, or groin nodes and spleen. Stage three would be lymph nodes and lymph node involvement and or splenic involvement above and below the diaphragm. And stage four would be disease in lymph nodes plus a site that's not a lymph node, what we call an extranodal site, which is lung, liver, bone marrow. As I mentioned, the B symptoms, fevers, night sweats, and weight loss have been incorporated in this system. So if you have none of these symptoms, you'd be an A, 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A. If you have any one of these symptoms, you would be a B, 1B, 2B, 3B, 4B. We have an additional thing that we put in the staging, which is a measure of the bulk of lymph node tumors. And if they are of a certain size, which we call bulky, there's a subscript of X. So you can be, if you have, for example, stage 2 disease in neck and a very large mass in the mediastinum in the chest, this would be called 2A or BX. So most people are cured with chemotherapy. Second-line high-dose chemotherapy, so-called autologous stem cell transplantation, as a second-line treatment can also be curative. And this has been the case for close to 40 years. However, we have developed there are new and exciting agents which are not chemotherapy, which have been recently introduced into treatment, and Dr. Nowakowski, my colleague, will be speaking of those in a few minutes. So the standard treatment in North America is a combination of drugs that's been used for, has been established for the last 25 years, which is called ABVD, which is adriamycin or doxorubicin, bleomycin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine. There is more intensive regimen, escalated Biocop, which is used in Europe, particularly in Germany, is more toxic and is not really preferred by most physicians in this country. So these days, we have reduced the use of radiation therapy and use it only when necessary because of the late effects of radiation therapy. And we're trying to limit it to smaller areas that are irradiated and limit the exposure of other organs. But my own approach is the following. For stage 1 and 2 Hodgkin without bulky disease, based on recent data, we treat with two or three cycles of ABVD. A cycle is given, is two treatments given every 2 weeks. And then we do a PET scan before and a PET scan after that. And if the PET scan is negative after three cycles, we may not give further treatment. Or if we do it after two cycles, we have very good results with, in even a larger number of patients, using sort of more liberal criteria for PET negativity. We found good results with continuing with two more cycles of ABVD, a total of four, without radiation therapy. Another standard that's used by many is ABVD and limited radiation therapy. For stage 1 and 2 with bulky disease, we do the same thing. We give ABVD for six cycles, total of 12 treatments. And if the PET scan is negative at the end of treatment, we don't give radiation therapy. However, Many people still in that setting, because of the risk of recurrence in sites that are originally bulky, will give radiation therapy in addition to the ABVD. And for stage 3 and 4 disease, we again use 6 cycles of chemotherapy. Recent data has allowed us to use a PET scan at the end of 2 cycles of ABVD, and if the PET scan is negative, we'll eliminate bleomycin from the succeeding 4 cycles, thereby limiting exposure to bleomycin and its attendant pulmonary toxicity. For PET-positive patients, interim PET, it's not clear what to do. You can go to more intensive chemotherapy with Biocop, or you can biopsy and go to second-line treatment with autologous transplantation, as I mentioned earlier. So I think I'm not sure if I'm a little over 10, but I think that sort of concludes my overview.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Strauss. That was very informative, really excellent, very comprehensive, and lots of wonderful information. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Greg Nowakowski. Dr. Nowakowski is Associate Professor of Medicine and Oncology, Consultant, Chair of Education, Division of Hematology, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. And Dr. Nowakowski is going to address targeted and emerging treatments, the role of clinical trials, and how research contributes to your treatment options. It's really my great pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Nowakowski.
Good afternoon. It is a great pleasure and honor to be able to participate in this excellent conference. Dr. Strauss very nicely overviewed the current standard therapy in Hodgkin's lymphoma and how we stage the disease. And what I would like to focus on is some of the newer developments in novel therapies of Hodgkin's lymphoma. Unfortunately, a number of patients will relapse after standard chemotherapy. And in recent years, we're fortunate to see a huge progress, essentially a revolution, in the way we can now treat relapse Hodgkin's lymphoma. Moreover, some of those treatments from relapse setting in patients who have a recurrent lymphoma after chemotherapy are now moving forward to frontline therapy. And I think we'll see it more and more as the time passes by. Now, all of this was really possible because of basic research. A lot of research had been done looking at Hodgkin's lymphoma. And from the research perspective, it is a fascinating disease because when you look under the microscope on Hodgkin's lymphoma, there are very few malignant cells. Cancer cells are maybe about 1 in 100 or 1 in 150 cells. The remaining of the cells which surround those Hodgkin's cancer cells are actually immune cells. There are our own body cells which are trying to destroy this cancer cell, but for some reason it cannot be done. And recently we've learned about some ways of addressing this and enable immune system to recognize Hodgkin's cancer cell and destroy it. But the progress has been also made by looking at the Hodgkin cell, cancer cell itself, and understanding some of the surface markers, some of the proteins which are being expressed or appeared on the surface of the cell, and also some signaling or communication of those cancer cells with other cells in the body. So one of the first breakthroughs was the drug called brentuximab vedotin, which is being used and is FDA approved for treatment of patients with relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I don't want to spend here much time talking about the drug development, but I would like to highlight a few things because it's a fascinating story. So if you look at the Hodgkin's lymphoma cell called Rich-Steinberg cell, so on the surface of the cancer cell, there's a protein called CD30. And we knew it for a very long time. And what we tried to do is to develop the antibody which would attach to this protein and make it visible to the immune system. And such an antibody had been developed, and we had a great hopes for this antibody that it could be very effective therapy in Hodgkin's. But it turns out that the cancer cell was actually smarter than us. So when this antibody was attaching to the cell surface, the cancer cell was swallowing the antibody, was internalizing it, and because of this, immune system still could not see a cancer cell. And then the breakthrough happened because this mechanism in which the antibody is being swallowed by cancer cell has been actually used to attach the poison to the antibody called vedotin. So brentuximab vedotin is an antibody conjugated with the poison. So this is how it works. This brentuximab vedotin can find the cancer cell, and after it attaches to cancer cell, the cancer cell is trying to avoid being recognized by immune system and essentially swallows or internalizes the antibody. And this leads to digestion of the antibody and release of the poison. So it's a very smart way of treating Hodgkin's cell lymphoma. And this treatment is now FDA approved, and it results in a high response rate and durable responses in a number of patients with Hodgkin's disease relapsing after standard therapy and after transplant. So effective therapy and is very smartly designed. The other example of therapy which was developed based on targeting the cancer cell itself is our mTOR inhibitors. So mTOR is a special pathway within the cancer which causes activation and progression of cancer cells. And there are mTOR, so-called mTOR inhibitors, the drugs which can stop this pathway. And one of those drugs is everolimus. And everolimus, although not approved in this indication, has been studied in different clinical trials and showed significant activity, single-agent activity, in patients with relapsed and refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so this is an example of the small molecule, different drug development, which can actually target specific survival pathway within a cancer cell and make it more likely to die, and therefore producing a clinical responses and clinical benefit. So that's one way of approaching things. This is targeting cancer cell itself. But already mentioned to you that there is this huge immune microenvironment, there's this huge immune response surrounding those cancer cells, and we always felt that there was something which prevented those, our own immune system, from destroying those cancer cells. And a lot of work had been done, and it turns out that there are proteins called checkpoints which stop the immune system from being able to eradicate cancer cell. And the cancer cell specifically in Hodgkin's lymphoma expresses this molecule called PD-L1. And what it does, it is essentially preventing immune system from recognizing cancer cell. It's a little bit like showing a fake ID to the law official so they cannot basically see you're a bad guy. So the cancer cell can still survive. And there are a number of antibodies now and molecules which can actually target this signaling pathway and interaction of this molecule. And those antibodies resulted in unprecedented responses and a clinical benefit in patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma, relapsed refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma. One of those antibodies is called pembrolizumab. The other one is called nivolumab. There are antibodies, so there are infusional drugs, which are given on every couple of weeks schedule. And they are generally very well tolerated. And what's fascinating about it is that the immune system has ability to eradicate those cancer cells relatively quickly. So I always felt that when those drugs will come around, maybe we'll see responses relatively slow. And it's still the case for some patients, but a lot of patients will have very brisk and very rapid responses with those new antibodies. So those antibodies really changed the way we approach relapsed Hodgkin's, and now they are both also FDA approved in this setting. So our number of options in patients with relapsed and refractory Hodgkin's lymphoma had expanded significantly, which leads me to the next point, that there are many more clinical trials ongoing right now, and there really are, we have two major objectives here. One, well, we have those antibodies or checkpoint inhibitors or anti-PD-1 antibodies which can activate the immune system. We also have those immunoconjugates like brentuximab vedotin, which I mentioned to you, which is working in this setting. So a lot of work is being done on how to incorporate those novel agents into the treatment of patients and how to combine them. So for example, combination of brentuximab vedotin with nivolumab has been studied, and there are many more similar combinations in this setting. The other thing that's being done is developing a whole new different antibodies which can stimulate the immune system as well. It turns out that in this immune recognition, there are other molecules which are also important, and a number of very promising agents are being understudied right now. So we hope that those new agents will enhance the properties of checkpoint inhibitors and make them even better in activating our own immune system to destroy cancer cells. Finally, although frontline chemotherapy cures a lot of patients and it's a great option, we always would like to improve this frontline therapy and limit some of the toxicity and make it even better. So a lot of effort now is being focused on taking some of those agents from the relapse refractory setting when we know that they are working and moving them to upfront therapy. So for example, in a chemotherapy, which Dr. Strauss has mentioned, in ABVD, there's an attempt of replacing one of the older drugs called bleomycin, so the B, with another B, which is brentuximab vedotin, and seeing if this the replacement would result in better results, and also limit toxicity, because bleomycin occasionally can cause lung injury and some other problems. So if we could replace it with a drug which is potentially less toxic, this would be of huge benefit. The same is true about PD-1 inhibitors, or nivolumab and pembrolizumab. There are attempts now to move it to upfront, wherein the immune system is actually not even affected by chemotherapy upfront, and see if this mounting of immune response could increase the benefit to the patients and the cure rate. In some of the patients who are not eligible for standard chemotherapy, like ABVD, because of other problems, sometimes heart issues, poor performance status, combination of brentuximab vedotin with nivolumab, for example, is now tried in a frontline setting to see if we can replace traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy with ABVD with the combination of those novel targeted agents. So in the last part, I just would like to highlight that this is really the critical time for development of new drugs in Hodgkin's lymphoma. We've seen this enormous progress, and we have those active agents already. We are just trying to make them even better by combining them with different agents. And also, we're trying to introduce even newer generation molecules. They are very different than what we had seen in the past. In the past, we tried a lot of chemotherapy. We tried a lot of so-called traditional cytotoxic therapy. This is different time now. We have targeted therapy. We have immunoconjugates, which target specifically cancer cells. And we have all those immune drugs, which can utilize patients' own immune system to fight cancer, which highlights the need to participate in the clinical trials whenever possible. I'm just sitting here and I'm looking at the postcard which I just got from one of my patients who had relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma 10 years ago. And this postcard was sent to me because the patient just had a baby. And this patient went through many, many clinical trials and was fortunate to have benefit from those clinical trials and is now in remission after therapy, one of the immune therapies for over 2 years, which is outstanding, something which we did not see in the past. And it shows you that there is a clear benefit to participation in a clinical trial, not only to advance science, which we all would like to do, but actually benefit to the patients. In fact, last year at ASCO, we were actually discussing that in general participation in a clinical trial in patients with relapsed lymphoma, including Hodgkin's lymphoma, that it actually does appear to be prolonged of benefit to patients in terms of the survival and overall well-being. And big part of this is because we now have those very active agents which we can use. And because they are targeted, they're actually much better tolerated than what the agents which we had in the past. So I think I will stop here, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Nowakowski. What a wonderful presentation, really, and what an inspirational story to have shared with all of us. So thank you for that, and thank you also for identifying really the benefits of participating in clinical trials and their importance, and certainly in the and Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's been particularly important. It's particularly important for every cancer. So thank you for highlighting that as well. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Alison Rosenthal. Dr. Rosenthal is hematology consultant, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Rosenthal is going to address tips to manage complications and side effects, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's now my great pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Rosenthal.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I'm happy to be here as well today. I think that was an excellent summary you've heard from both people so far, and I've been tasked with covering a lot of information in a short period of time, so I'll get to what I think are probably a lot of the questions people have, I hope, but if there are extras later, we'll have some time to answer them. So initially, to speak about complications and side effects of treatment, I thought I'd start with ABVD, since that's the general treatment that most people get at the start of being diagnosed with Hodgkin lymphoma. And as you've heard, it is four different drugs. The adriamycin, which is the red one, or orangish in color, is the one that can give people some difficulty when it comes to nausea. So what I do with my patients is I have them take anti-nausea medicines for 2 days after chemotherapy, no matter what, whether they feel nauseous or not, just to get them through that period where they might be the most nauseous. And sometimes that includes giving people a little bit of oral steroids because that's good for nausea after you've had chemotherapy. And we have a lot of different anti-nausea medicines available to people. So in my opinion, it's pretty unacceptable to have a lot of nausea and vomiting today with chemotherapy. And I know that's something that concerns patients anytime they're just being told they need to get treatment. So we have all kinds of medicines. Sometimes it takes a little bit of experimenting to find the right cocktail that helps you individually, but for the most part, we should be able to control that pretty easily. This is also the medicine that you need the ultrasound of your heart done prior to treatment as well, as it can impact the strength of your heart muscle over time. And so it's something we keep an eye on when people are receiving this treatment. The second medicine in ABVD is bleomycin. And that's the one you can get lung function testing done prior. And the reason for that is it can actually cause some injury to the lungs. So what you can do to prevent that is not smoke. And I don't mean just cigarettes, not smoke. Don't smoke anything if you're getting bleomycin because that will increase the possibility of you having lung injury. Also, we generally avoid things like Neupogen and Neulasta for people getting chemotherapy for Hodgkin's as there may be an increased risk of lung toxicity when they're combined. Although some people would argue otherwise, I think for the most part, most people don't use the growth factors. And for that reason, your white count will be low through the duration of your treatment. The third medicine in ABVD, vinblastine, has some specific side effects of its own as well, primarily being constipation. And this is an opportunity to be proactive so that it's not a big deal. And so I counsel all my patients on this as well and make sure that they have stool softeners on hand and a plan for if they do get constipated after chemotherapy. And the other thing it can do is cause neuropathy, which would be burning, numbness, tingling in your fingers, toes, and feet. It's usually dose-dependent, meaning the more you get, the more likely that is to happen, the exception being people who have neuropathy already from some other condition. Unfortunately, it sometimes is permanent. Sometimes we'll get a little better after treatment. And of all the things that have been done in small studies and placebo-controlled studies even to try and abate the neuropathy or keep it from happening, we don't have a good strategy to prevent it. There are some medicines that will help alleviate it some, but we don't have a good preventative strategy. Lastly, there's dacarbazine, which is the D in ABVD. It doesn't have a lot of side effects specific to itself, but it can irritate your veins. So if you're sore in your arm after you've had your infusion, it's probably the dacarbazine. And for that reason, most people who get ABVD will actually end up with a PICC line or a port, some sort of central catheter to make it a little bit easier on you. Then we've talked a little bit about brentuximab, which is one of the newer treatments for Hodgkin lymphoma. This medicine will also cause neuropathy, which is also dose-dependent, meaning the more doses you get, the more likely it is to occur. Unlike vinblastine, the neuropathy that comes with brentuximab has been shown to be mostly reversible. So for most people, it essentially goes away in some period of time after treatment, but that isn't the case for everybody, but there is some good news there that most of the time it does get better. It can also upset your stomach a little bit, cause fever and rash, but the most common thing people complain about is the neuropathy. And then the third medicine I wanted to highlight was one of these checkpoint inhibitors you just heard about. So nivolumab has been around a little bit longer than pembrolizumab. And the side effects from that medication generally include what I call the itises. So So we run the risk by waking up your immune system, waking it up a little bit too well, and causing things like pneumonitis, which would be inflammation in the lungs, colitis, inflammation in the colon, hepatitis, inflammation of the liver, and so forth. So those are things that we keep an eye on for patients who are receiving this therapy, and sometimes it requires a treatment break and some steroids to kind of shut it down if you have a bad side effect. The good news is with the new checkpoint inhibitors, your hair comes back, you don't have a lot of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, you generally feel pretty good aside from having to come see us every 2 or 3 weeks for your treatments. There are some other side effects that I think are common with chemotherapy for Hodgkin's, one being hair loss. So a lot of the chemotherapies will make your hair fall out. We don't have a good way of predicting who's going to lose their eyelashes and eyebrows too, but I know that can be pretty troubling to people, so common for a lot of folks. Taste and appetite change is another big deal. So a lot of people will complain of a metallic taste after they've had chemotherapy or just a lack of taste buds. That's common also. You just do your best to find something that tastes good. Don't worry about counting calories. You can put flavor drops in your water. Sometimes that will help take the metallic taste away from plain water. Small snack-sized meals can be helpful, and there are some cancer cookbooks out there that have some strategies to help make things taste a little bit better. Another side effect that can happen is mouth sores. We do have some swish and swallow or swish and spit mouth rinses that we can compound if that becomes a problem. I've had some patients tell me that if they chew ice during the Adriamycin part of ABVD, that helps. It seems to help breast cancer patients a little bit less clear in Hodgkin's. Fatigue. So this is a big one, and it seems to add up as treatment goes on. Most people get through the first half, if not a little bit more, of treatment without feeling too terrible. So rest when you need it, but not too much. Do your best to stay active. If you have an exercise program already, that can be helpful in maintaining some energy, and then what we call energy conservation strategies. So when you feel good, get up and do some stuff. We need to rest. You got to rest. I think another thing that can be really impactful is chemo brain or kind of chemo fog. And what that means is you might feel like you have some short-term memory issues or concentration difficulties. This is pretty common with all kinds of chemotherapy, but be patient with yourself. It should go away towards, you know, sometime after treatment, but it may be worse towards the end of treatment. So this happens to a lot of people too. We don't understand really why it happens and don't have a strategy for preventing it either, but know that you're not alone and it's pretty common. And then the last thing I want to talk about side effect-wise is your body's going to feel different after chemotherapy. So most people who have not known anyone to have chemotherapy or had it themselves will think they're going to lose a bunch of weight, but the alternative is usually what happens. People gain weight during chemotherapy, and that's partly because we use steroids as part of the treatment, but partly just because your body composition changes. This happens to almost everybody, and there'll be some time to get yourself back to what you feel as normal in the aftermath. The second thing I've been asked to talk about today is quality of life, and I think a lot of the things I've just talked about side effect-wise have a big impact on quality of life, but I do want to say one separate thing. So if when you start treatment for your Hodgkin lymphoma, you find that you're feeling badly and it's a result of your lymphoma, so you've got night sweats or fevers or you're itchy or you've got a cough because you have lymph nodes that are big in your chest, the good news is those things go away pretty quickly with treatment. Usually within the first 1 or 2 infusions of chemotherapy, do you have a lot of relief from those symptoms? So I can usually make people feel better before I make them feel bad. But also know that if you are having side effects from your chemo, this isn't a what I call no pain, no gain situation. So if you let us know that you're not doing well, or if you're having a lot of nausea or you have pain or something, we can help as long as we know. But if you tough it out and don't tell us, it's hard for us to address those issues. The other things I think are important to talk about are a lot of people ask me if they can work. And I think having work and something normal in your life is a good way to keep some quality of life. And I tell my patients most of the time, based on where they're employed, that they can if they feel up to it. But your doctor will let you know based on your occupation if that's all right. I plan, though, to take some time off towards the end of treatment if you're having more than a couple months of therapy because the fatigue does kind of add up and it gets hard to go. The other thing I get a lot of questions about is emotions. And so emotions come and go. You can feel like you're on a bit of a roller coaster. That is very normal, and a lot of people experience that. It makes people feel nervous, depressed, sometimes guilty if they've gotten through treatment and they know others who have not. You might want to feel like you want to isolate yourself or even sabotage some of your relationships. So if friends and family are listening and caregivers of patients, now be patient with the patient. This isn't their best state, and that's pretty common for things to be up and down and have good days and bad days. So there are resources out there for that as far as counseling and social work and psychiatrists and psychologists, and I think we'll get to that at the end of today's presentation. But just know you're not alone, and those feelings are very normal. And then lastly, you know, there are some questions about family. So a lot of our Hodgkin's patients will have kids. So be prepared. Your roles may reverse. If you are a parent who's in charge of taking care of the kids when you're on chemotherapy, you may have to avoid them a little bit. If you've got little kids, they're sick most of the time. And, of course, we always worry about infection and people getting treatment. So you may have to spend some time being careful with exposure to sick kids. And then fertility concerns are another big quality of life thing we address with our young Hodgkin's patients. So the good news is ABVD is unlikely to make people infertile, but it does happen sometimes. So there's usually time to prepare for that, and you can do sperm banking or harvest eggs as long as your doctor doesn't think there's an urgent reason to start your treatment as a backup plan, but most people are able to conceive naturally after they have had something like ABVD. The more treatment you get, that's a little bit harder to predict, but at least with initial therapy, it's not usually a big deal. And then the last thing, communicating with your healthcare team, this is really important. You know, this is a two-way street, and we want to hear from you how you're doing and not just tell you what we're going to do to you. You get to be part of this experience and take some ownership of your own medical care. So when you meet your doctor the first time, it's helpful, I think, if you bring somebody with you, at least to your first visit and maybe even to your restaging visits where you've had a scan, for moral support and for somebody else to take notes and make sure you're not missing anything important. You know, make sure that you know what your diagnosis is and what your stage is, what your treatment plan is going to be, how long you'll need treatment, what the expectations are at the end. Are you going to be cured, or is this palliative, meaning we're just buying time and trying to control stuff? Who do you call if you have questions? Who do you call if you have an emergency? Make sure you have those numbers on hand. And then know who's on your team. You'll at least have a doctor. You'll probably have other people as part of your team, your chemotherapy nurses, maybe a different nurse in your doctor's office, social work. A lot of hospitals will have patient advocates or navigators that can help you through this process as well. And as I mentioned before, you know, you're your best advocate. If you're not feeling right and something isn't normal, you tell us and we'll do our best to help. But if you don't tell us, it's hard to know. If you don't know what's going on with your medicines, how to take them or what they're for, ask us. I know it's unusual, usually in young people, to be on a bunch of medicines prior to having treatment, and so you have all kinds of new medicines you've never had to take before. It's really important for us to know if you have a fever or you think you have an infection. The faster we act on those things, the better things turn out. Be an active participant in this process. Be assertive. Tell people if something isn't working for you, or if things need to be done differently. And then befriend your nurses. They're your allies. They'll know all the tricks of the trade that your doctor may not know because they're at the bedside every day helping people through this. And then lastly, I think this is very important. Please ask us if you're thinking of starting new herbs, supplements, vitamins, natural remedies, or anything you get over the counter. Some of those things are okay, but some of them we don't know, and some of them for sure will interact with your treatment. We don't want to do anything and get in our own way when we're trying to make you better. So I think that's a highlight of what I think is important and things I try to address with patients when they come in with a diagnosis of Hodgkin's, and I hope that was valuable, and feel free to ask me any questions when Caroline opens it up to questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rosenthal. That was very helpful. And you know, really addressed a lot of the issues that people struggle with in terms of treatment side effects and managing them, the complications and quality of life. So you really did an excellent job. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next and final speaker is Ms. Essie Roman. Ms. Roman is an oncology social worker, and she's a program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. Ms. Roman?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be part of this telephone education workshop. I'd like to start by talking about the importance of having support when you're diagnosed with Hodgkin lymphoma and how Cancer Care and our Hopeline can be of help to you. As we have learned from today's workshop, there is a lot of information about Hodgkin lymphoma to take in, and sometimes it's hard to understand what this means for you. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer like Hodgkin's lymphoma affect a person, their family, partners, and friends. They are also trained to help with cancer and their families tackle the problems that come along with the disease, such as practical and financial demands, physical changes, and the social and emotional impact of Hodgkin lymphoma. Adjusting to and coping with the disease is an important part of your journey that you don't have to face alone. Cancer Care can help in many ways, such as our practical and financial help. We can also offer you to other financial assistance resources. Our emotional support services are provided by licensed oncology social workers in a variety of settings such as telephone counseling, online, and telephone support groups. We realize that cancer affects the whole family and the entire family. asking for help by contacting a cancer care social worker for counseling or by joining a support group is a sign of strength. Counseling can help you explore the tools you need in order to cope. For many people with cancer, talking to a psychologist, to a social worker, relieves them from the stress of holding it all inside and shielding loved ones from their struggle. Cancer Care offers a wide variety of support groups as well. In addition to offering support groups for people with cancer, we offer support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and loved ones. Many people find being in a support group is a way of connecting to others who are going through the same situation or have similar problems. Individual counseling and support groups are a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and your fears. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people experience. Feeling emotionally well can help you deal with your diagnosis of Hodgkin lymphoma and the treatment you face. All of our services are completely free of charge. If you would like to speak with an oncology social worker, please contact 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information. In addition, as you know, our Connect Education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Our booklets and fact sheets are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help people diagnosed with cancer and those who care for them. These are two additional tools that can help you. Again, all of these materials are available free of charge. Please remember that you're not alone. While we may not be able to eliminate the problems you experience, we are here for you and Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Effie. That was really wonderful. And now people have a sense of some of these resources they can access as well. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Ayala, explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your questions, which sometimes happens, we have a lot of you on the call, of course, then we will actually, I'll give you direction at the end of how to get your questions answered. But let's see how many we can take now. Ayala?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one.
So we have questions from some of our online participants. I'm going to start with this first question. I'm going to address this question to Dr. Strauss. To start with. So the question is, if you don't have a strong immune system due to Hodgkin's disease, would the checkpoint inhibitors work well? So Dr. Strauss, if you could address that question.
Well, yes. I mean, the Hodgkin lymphoma is associated with a somewhat impaired immunity. So it was a bit of a surprise that there are drugs that can kind of unleash the immune system to very effectively fight the Hodgkin lymphoma. And actually, the responses and the activity of these drugs in Hodgkin lymphoma, a disease with an underlying immunodeficiency state, are even better than their effects on many other cancers. So it is a bit of a surprise, but Hodgkin lymphoma is definitely a disease of the immune system that goes awry, and it appears now we have, for the first time in 40 years, we have drugs that are not chemotherapy that are very effective, and they are so by boosting the immune system.
Excellent. Thank you. An excellent question, excellent response. Thank you. And we have another question, which I'm going to direct, an online question, which I'm going to direct to Dr. Nowakowski. So for patients on watchful waiting, wondering when treatment is needed after a few years, all the diagnostic tests should be repeated due to, let me start again. For patients on watchful waiting, wondering when treatment is needed after a few years, all the diagnostic tests should be repeated due to the risk of transformation? Dr. Narukowski, is that a clear question to address?
Yes. So I think this question might be actually referring to some of the slowly growing non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, in which occasionally we use watchful waiting, and they can actually transform to more aggressive lymphoma. In Hodgkin's lymphoma, which we've been discussing today, this strategy of watchful waiting has not been typically used, possibly with the exception of a lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma, which nodular lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma, which falls a little bit into a different category, in which case some patients can have relatively indolent and slowly progressive disease. And we actually observe selected patients in this situation, and there is some relatively modest risk of transformation to aggressive lymphoma, typically diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in those patients. But that's a relatively small subset of Hodgkin's lymphoma patients, and typically we would not watch a majority of patients with classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. I'd be curious what others, for example, Dr. Strauss, would comment on this as well.
Dr. Strauss, did you want to?
Well, we cure most of the patients with Hodgkin lymphoma. So if the majority of patients will achieve a complete remission and remain in it. And if you have a relapse, it's usually going to be within the first 2 to 3 years. So after a period of 3 to 5 years, we even stop following people routinely for recurrence. So it's a little bit different from, as Dr. Nowakowski said, some of the low-grade non-Hodgkin lymphomas. Lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin lymphoma is 5% or less of Hodgkin lymphoma. It's different from what we call classical Hodgkin lymphoma. It is more like the low-grade non-Hodgkin lymphomas than classical Hodgkin lymphomas. And again, watchful waiting, I think, in my practice, I do in the majority of patients because they really have an excellent survival and nothing you do is really going to change that. And again, the clear indication in that setting would be transformation to a more aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma, as Dr. Nowakowski indicated.
So I hope this helps our caller to go back to treating healthcare team with this information. Of course, ask them. They know all the details, but an excellent question. Thank you. And we now have a question from one of our telephone participants, so Ayala.
We have a question from Edmund E. Your line is now open.
Yes, I was a participant in the early non-Hodgkin's vaccine study back in 2000. I was wondering if there's any similar vaccine studies being done with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and or our immunological with the CAR T cells, is that being done in Hodgkin's?
Excellent question. I ask all of our speakers to address that. Dr. Strauss, do you want to start with that question?
I'm not aware of any active vaccine trials at the present time. I think there are some studies being developed for CAR T cells directed at things on the surface of the Hodgkin lymphoma cells, but there's not a lot of information about that as yet. I believe that some approaches with CAR T cells, which are actually T lymphocytes from patients, the immune cells from patients that are armed with something that attaches to the tumor and allows them to attack the tumor. And this is used in acute lymphoblastic leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And there are patients who've been treated. There's data, and there even may be approval soon for non-Hodgkin lymphoma. This approach, I think, is really in its development and infancy in Hodgkin lymphoma. I don't know if Dr. Nowakowski or Dr. Rosenthal have any more information about that.
Dr. Nowakowski or Dr. Rosenthal, do you want to comment about the question in general as well? Yes.
No, I think Dr. Strauss outlined it quite well. This is very early on with the CAR T cell-like approaches for Hodgkin's. it's the major development right now has been in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and B-cell ALL.
Dr. Rosenthal, did you
I have nothing else.
The patients asking these questions. Okay.
Yeah,
I just want to add that this is a wonderful audience. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. this is actually a wonderful audience because you are actually taking what you hear in other areas and wondering how it applies to you. So I appreciate the, we appreciate your asking the questions and the clarification from our speakers. But we do also like to think that you're a group of really thoughtful thinkers. You're critical thinkers about you know, what else is there out for you. So we do appreciate these questions. They're excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants. And I'm going to address this question to Dr. Nowakowski. I'm 59-year-old female, has been diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, nodular lymphocyte predominant type 13 years ago. I was treated with radiation therapy. I have relapsed in terms of having enlarged lymph nodes biopsied, but nothing determined, one in the groin and one in the armpit area. No symptoms. This has been going on for over a year with regular CAT scanning, rescheduled every few months to watch me closely. Is there anything else you can add? And she does also add that she does have like a recent CAT scan. So if there's anything else that you wish to add, Dr. Nowakowski. And again, we of course going to answer your question in a general way and then of course recommend that you of course go back to your treating healthcare team with whatever information you learned today to see how they feel that applies to your situation. But Dr. Nowakowski, did you want to add anything here?
Yes, I think it relates to this previous question as well about watching some of the patients with nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin cell lymphoma. And it looks like the behavior of the disease at this point appears to be indolent. And the strategy of watching and watching carefully for symptoms, it's as frequently utilized in this setting. Provided, again, we have to review the much more things in details, but provided that there's no symptoms and there's relative stability, that's a very reasonable approach.
Excellent. Thank you. And actually, there is one last late-breaking question, actually. And I'm going to give that question to Dr. Rosenthal. What do you recommend for survivors for follow-up screening to monitor for possible long-term effects? So Dr. Rosenthal, if you could just address that in terms of just
sure.
long-term effects.
Sure. So there are guidelines in place for specifically that. And so it depends on what treatment you had in the beginning and whether or not your initial therapy involved radiation therapy and where the radiation was delivered. And so as far as follow-up for lung, well, and whether or not you needed a stem cell transplant as part of your treatment. So in general, for people who had radiation to the chest at a young age, there are guidelines in follow-up for ultrasounds of the heart. As we know, there is some risk to the heart valves if you received a high dose of radiation there, as well as what we call accelerated atherosclerosis or hardening of the vessels. There is also guidelines for starting mammograms sooner if you were a woman than if you had not had radiation to the chest, as well as some screening for potential secondary cancers like lung cancer if the radiation field involved the lungs. The other follow-up is if you've had radiation to the neck or chest, thyroid function testing should be done periodically because you can develop low thyroid as a result of the radiation. As far as long-term follow-up from chemotherapy goes, I guess it's up to your provider how long they follow up Hodgkin's patients. Some of us will decide to keep them and see you guys once a year, even in the aftermath of your treatment. Some people will be sent back to their primary care provider, at which point, you know, symptomatic repeat ultrasounds of the heart and things like that. We generally don't repeat lung function tests on asymptomatic patients unless they've had an allogeneic stem cell transplant or a transplant from someone other than themselves. I don't know if that answers your question, but the guidelines are easy to find online as far as what the follow-up recommendations are for repeat testing, and we don't indefinitely scan people. It's important that you have some follow-up either with oncology or with your primary care doctor, as people who have had Hodgkin's do have a slightly increased risk of second cancers related to their treatment or not, but it's important that you do have ongoing medical care.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been phenomenal. You can't hear us applauding, but we are applauding you. I also want to thank all of our participants. I have to say your questions were really extraordinary questions, both on the telephone and online, participating and asking really such great questions that really enhance our call, of course, allowing our speakers to address your questions and really helping everybody to think their questions through. Now, I did say that if you did have, and I know some of you still have questions that have not been answered, that I do want to let you all know how to get your questions answered that we didn't get to. Well, first of all, of course, your healthcare team is always a wonderful place to go to in terms of, you know, getting questions answered specifically. And we hope you have some ideas from today's call about how to get your questions answered, how to approach. You know, the team, I think, as Dr. Rosenthal said quite clearly, that if you don't tell them, they don't know what your questions are. So please do bring your concerns to them. But some of you do like to Google and find some additional information. We always recommend the National Cancer Institute as a wonderful resource. There are 800 numbers, 1-800-422-6237, and you'll also be getting all this information from us when you get your evaluations. We'll have all of the information about resources that I mentioned and other resources that you might find useful. In addition, the National Cancer Institute also has a website, www.cancer.gov, and the wonderful thing about that website is it has a live chat feature. So for both people in the U.S. and internationally, it's a great way to pose a question to an information specialist at the National Cancer Institute, and they will then address your question and help you to think it through and then, of course, go back to your treating healthcare team with some additional information. So we hope you'll take advantage of that. Also on today's program, we have partnered with a number of different organizations in the blood cancer sphere, as well as cancer in general. And all of those are terrific resources for you as well. So definitely, we hope that you'll feel armed with ways to get your questions answered. Also, if some of you, however, would like to take advantage of cancer care services from our oncology social workers, whether it be practical or financial assistance or counseling services, or to participate in future programs like this one, or to get publications, or then I would suggest that you contact our 800 number, 1-800-813-4673, or pose your question at our website, www.cancercare.org. And we will definitely connect all of you with an oncology social worker, whether you contact us on the phone or whether you actually contact us on the web. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I really don't want any one of you to feel that you're alone. And I know that you all do have those moments when you do feel alone. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support of cancer care and all the other infrastructure of organizations that exist to help you that we can connect you to as well as here. So please do contact us if we can be of any help to you, or even if you're not sure how we can help you, you can contact us as well. And I do want to point to your attention to a program that we're doing called Life with Cancer, a guide to getting the best care. And many of you, that's for all people with all types of cancer, and many people are finding these programs very helpful and interesting, and you'll be getting information about these programs and all the different topics offered which may be useful to you. So again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.